Welcome back, everybody. This is Mark Steiner, and good to have you over this today. The lines are open at 410-319-8888. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner. Send an email to talk@steinershow.org as we continue today's program here. This with Danny McLean now, contributing writer for The Nation, fellow at The Nation Institute, where she focuses on race and reproductive justice, and has joined us numerous times in the show, so many times I can't even count them anymore. Danny, welcome. Good to have you with us again.
Hi, good morning, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Always, always. So let's just begin with this. There have been so many interesting cases, the Supreme Court decision and how that affects access to abortion. We can talk about the decision around Indiana now as well, and really kind of attacking that law. I mean, this is for all the years where it seemed like people who were pro-choice, who believed in the woman's right to choose, that their backs were completely against the wall. Has something shifted, or is this just an anomaly of the moment?
No, I think that something certainly has shifted. I mean, so, you know, just to start off, because I think the Supreme Court ruling late last month shows, you know, that this isn't just about Texas, as you point out. This is going to have implications for the rest of the country. So just to, if I could start off by talking just a bit about that ruling.
Yeah, please. So,
you know, what was at issue was House Bill 2, which was a Texas law that had been, you know, passed by the legislature and signed into law back in 2013 by then Governor Rick Perry. And more specifically, what was at issue is two regulations within that law. This was an anti-abortion law that said specifically that abortion clinics needed to meet standards that were set for so-called ambulatory surgical centers. So these are basically regulations that would make clinics like mini hospitals. So these kind of requirements around the hallway size and equipment and staffing. And then the other regulation was around mandating that doctors had what's called hospital admitting privileges. So would be able to admit a patient to a hospital within 30 miles. And what advocates and people who run these clinics argued was that these were unnecessary requirements that would essentially limit access to abortion for people in Texas. And in fact, that's what happened. I mean, so this law was passed in 2013. Within the past 3 years, you saw the number of clinics in Texas drop from 40 to 20. And essentially what happened with the ruling was that, you know, a majority of justices on the Supreme Court agreed with what clinics and many major medical organizations had said, which was that these regulations were doing absolutely nothing to keep women safer, which is what its proponents had argued, and that in fact these regulations were placing an undue burden on people who needed to, you know, seek access to abortion or get abortion care. And that, you know, is driving these regulations and restrictions were forcing women to drive, you know, miles, hundreds of miles to other parts of the state or even out of state in order to get the medical care that they needed. And so with this 5-3 ruling, which, of course, the backdrop to all of this is Scalia's death in February and the fact that this could have easily gone to this could have been a 4-4, but it wasn't the majority. Justice Kennedy surprised some folks by joining the liberal wing of the court to make it a 5-3 majority. You know, it sets the standard in Texas, but as you pointed out, has huge implications for the rest of the country as well, from Indiana to Mississippi to Alabama to Wisconsin.
It's interesting. It's a little bit of an aside, but not completely, because I was thinking about what Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg wrote in her opinion, and she brought the name of Kermit Gosnell up, who was also brought up by those who pushed for the Texas law. So it was an interesting way she kind of went back at that. Maybe you can describe that a little bit. I found that really interesting.
Yeah, well, I mean, Gosnell's name is used. Kermit Gosnell was a provider in, I think, Philadelphia, who he's used as this, like, boogeyman, right? I mean, he was there were very troubling things that were happening in his clinic. And so, as you mentioned, for the right wing and for, you know, opponents to abortion, his name is often trotted out as, a kind of stand-in for all providers, that they're all engaged in these horrific practices that actually, really do leave women and women unsafe, people unsafe. But I think that, that was a very, luckily, a very rare situation, what was happening in his clinic. And I think what is important about the opinion that Ruth Bader Ginsburg wrote is that she is pointing out, she's pointing out the real risk to, highlighting the risk for unsafe self-induced abortion. So if we limit access to clinics and, providers, then people are going to take it, into their own hands. People will not just not get abortions. They'll take it into their own hands and figure out some way to self-induce. And I think it was the last time I was on your show, Mark, that we were talking about, and this was back in March, how there was this story in the New York Times that pointed out that last year there were 700,000 Google searches for how to self-induce abortion. And that the state with the highest rate of these searches was Mississippi, which of course is a state that has only one remaining clinic as a result of all the laws that have been passed limiting access. So I think Ginsburg's opinion was really pointing out that if Texas's law had been allowed to stand, we would have been seeing, not a Gosnell creating harmful situations for women and families, but people desperate to terminate their pregnancies and taking it up on themselves to do so.
I think I'll go back to the past. I think it's really important to throw this out here. I was thinking about this the other day that that people forget a lot about what happened when women could not legally get a legal and safe abortion, a safe and legal abortion. Mm. And as someone who grew up in that era and who was deeply involved in that, that there were over a million and a half of abortions a year that were done illegally in America in the 50s and 60s. And one of the estimates, you read two different estimates. The low estimate I've read is that up to 5,000 women a year died as a result of back alley abortions. And that's a number we don't talk about very much. Or think about these adult women, these young women who died as a result of that. And I think that's in a kind of our, in some people's zeal, that it gets lost what happened before 1970.
Mm-hmm. I think that's an excellent point. What's interesting is that there's so much of the advocacy and the activism and the people who've shown up on the courthouse steps, not just in DC, at the Supreme Court, but all over the country, wherever there is a fight in any of these states where there's an effort to restrict abortion rights, we see young people. I mean, young people are really leading the charge in terms of being willing to protest and talk about their own abortions, or talking about, accompanying a friend or a partner to have an abortion. And I think it's fascinating because many of them, they can't remember that era, but they know that they don't want to go back to it. They've heard the stories from people who are, their elders in the movement, and they're very certain that the rights that they gained through Roe and that have been, upheld until just, these past 5 to 7 years of just major restrictions being passed through state legislatures. These young people are used to an era of having their rights protected, and they know that they don't want to go back. So I think it's important for people like you, Mark, and others who lived through that era to keep telling the story as a reminder of what's really at stake.
I agree completely. I think that's something we just forget completely. And I'm thinking that the ramifications of what happened in the Supreme Court are huge. I mean, because they threaten now the laws that were put in place by many states,
right,
that restrict the abortion. Look what just happened in Indiana,
right.
And we now where they in the in Indiana, a federal judge blocked them from enforcing this new law that banned abortions motivated by questions of race, gender,
yeah,
disability of the fetus, whatever, and they threw that down.
And the day after the Supreme Court ruling, the court announced that it would not review two lower court decisions out of Wisconsin and Mississippi. They were very similar to the restrictions that were struck down in Texas, requiring providers in those states to have admitting privileges at a local hospital. So this really puts the whole, many states were trying to pass this admitting privileges regulation. And so we see the effect that it's going to have there in Wisconsin and Mississippi and Alabama. The attorney general announced that the state would no longer try to defend its admitting privileges requirement. There's a new challenge that was filed in district court, I think last week, to challenge the many abortion restrictions that were passed through the Louisiana state legislature this past session. I think, this is going to have a huge impact all over the country, and we're already seeing how that's unfolding.
I also want to think about something that's come up on the show a lot when we've talked about this, especially when people have called in and we've had these raging debates over the questions of genocide in communities of color around abortion. And then it comes up all the time. And I think, and it comes from a very profound place, given the history of racism in America and genocide against people of color in this country. But one of the things I think it does maybe begs the question also is that is putting the money back into asex education, putting money back into funding so people can have access to birth control and controlling their lives and whether or not they want to have a child before they make love, have a sex act. You know what I'm saying? I mean, that's something that gets lost in this as well. I mean, that.
I mean, I agree with you that, the genocide conversation is difficult because it does come from maybe not a keen awareness of the facts related to the history of reproductive coercion in this country, but it comes from people knowing that Black people, low-income people, people considered, mentally deficient in some way by the state, Latinas for sure, that there are many communities in this country who were essentially told not to reproduce and forced, and had their reproduction controlled by the state. And so when I hear people talk about this Black genocide, or Margaret Sanger was trying, placed her clinics specifically in Black neighborhoods in an effort to make sure that Black families were not sustaining themselves. I get it. I get where that concern comes from. However, it's simply just not factual. I mean, Margaret Sanger came into Black communities at the invitation of Black leaders who understood that families, women were, having to have children, have additional children, that they had real questions about how they were going to support. They were responding to an economic need and a demand on the part of Black people themselves. It wasn't some kind of coercive act. But I think, to your other point, it's an excellent point. I think so often when we talk about reproductive rights, the focus is on abortion access, and that's critical for all the reasons that we've spent the past 20 minutes talking about. But too often we overlook the importance of access to reliable contraception. We certainly, no one talks about sex ed and the types of sex education that most young people are getting in their schools is just terrible and lacking, and has very little to do with actually what I think is at the heart of good sex ed, which is learning how to negotiate relationships, learning, developing a sense of self-worth, especially for young women, learning that your no has meaning and that you're allowed to say no, you're allowed to negotiate around what's actually pleasurable for you and what makes you feel good, what you want to do. And I think that, I mean, having a conversation about how to fight restrictions against science-based, solid sex ed in schools would be incredibly important. And we don't see much of that.
So what do you think comes next? I mean, the groups that are anti-abortion and want to end abortion in America say that there are many other types, as some people have been quoted, of anti-abortion laws that can stand up in court and invalidate the high court decision and more. So what do you think, what are the next stages here, do you think?
That's a good question. I mean, I think one thing that's that was interesting was a quote from Amy Hagstrom Miller. She's the founder and CEO of Whole Women's Health, which is they were the lead plaintiff in the Texas Supreme Court case. And she pointed out, you know, I was paying attention to what advocates and activists who are pro-choice were saying, have been saying these past couple of weeks. And this founder and CEO of Whole Woman's Health pointed out that clinics don't reopen overnight, and that her organization, they run clinics all over the country. Four of their eight clinics are located in Texas. And she said, you know, now we have to figure out whether and how we can reopen our tech centers. I'm sorry, our health centers that were forced to shut their doors. That means renewing leases, hiring staff, working with the communities that they had served to try to figure out how to get up and running again. So I think, you know, it's important that we acknowledge that you know, yes, this ruling came down and that it's a cause for celebration for many advocates, attorneys, many people and everyday folks who support choice. And yet there's still, you know, when half a state's clinics close, there's a lot of work that needs to get done to get them back up and running. In terms of what's next, on the legal side for anti-abortion advocates, I'm not really sure. I mean, they never cease to surprise me, the things that they come up with. You know, and the ambulatory surgical center requirements, the admitting privileges, those are just two of the many types of laws that they, you know, have succeeded in passing in the states these past years. There are also you know, laws requiring women to wait up to 72 hours between an initial consultation and getting an abortion, laws that ban abortion after 20 weeks or even earlier, which is much earlier than the window of access that was outlined in Roe. So they, you know, they have a whole bag of tricks. And I think, you know, I will be interested to see what's next in terms of their strategies.
Well, Dan McLean, is always a pleasure to have you on the air with us. Your clear thinking is always welcome on this airway. So thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Dana McLean, contributing writer for The Nation, fellow of The Nation Institute, where she focuses on race and reproductive justice. Again, thank you. Thank you all for listening in today and being part of the program. As always, it means a great deal to us. I want to let you know that about an upcoming event, Baltimore, The Rise of Charm City, WEA's innovative new audio documentary series produced in partnership with AIR, Association for Independence and Radio, is wrapping up its inaugural 12-episode season. To celebrate, WEAA and show creator Stacia Brown invite you to an elegant evening of live storytelling that honors the history of some of Baltimore City's most beloved businesses and neighborhoods. The event's taking place on Thursday, July 14th from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Frederick Douglass Isaac Myers Maritime Museum. Dessert and wine reception, tickets, and more information available on Facebook at Baltimore City, The Rise of Charm City. Join us there. It'll be a great evening to honor the work these women have done and to continue their great work here on WEAA. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our senior producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. And I want to welcome our new producer, Imani Spence, whose first day is today. Welcome, Imani Spence, to The Mark Steiner Show. Our engineer is Andre Melton. Our interns are Morgan Barber and Calvin Curry. And Wyman Jones answered the phones today. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. Send me your thoughts about today's program to talk@steinershow.org. The podcast of Mark Steiner Show. And share it with your friends. Visit us on the web at steinershow.org or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. And for your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.